Hey, welcome back to How to Be Queer. This is Sam.
This is Chris.
And this is Kellum. And today we are talking to Max about horror. Welcome, Max. Hi, Max.
Hi.
How are you today?
I'm good. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. One of the first things that we love to do here on How to Be Queer is allow folks to introduce themselves with their pronouns, their name, and any other identifiers or labels that you love.
My name is Max Mosher. I'm a writer and communications professional, and my pronouns are he, him, his. In terms of title, I mean, I think I'll just put in my plug that I sometimes write about film for The Town, which is a website dedicated to all things film in Toronto. And I'm the old Hollywood correspondent, which is a title that my editor came up with, which I love so much. So when you said title, I was like, I'm just going to go for it. I'm going to call out that I'm an old Hollywood correspondent.
Absolutely. Is there any specific part of the queer community that you identify with or that you would like to share with our listeners?
I am gay.
What a coincidence, me too.
Same here. Yeah. Wow.
It's a bunch of gays over here. This is great.
Bunch of gays in the room.
It's funny that we all know each other when we're gay.
I know. So for some of our listeners, you may notice that Max and I are a little bit friendly. And so the reason behind that is because Max and I have been work pals on and off for three years, Max?
Yeah, I feel like it's only like 2.5, but it feels like far longer that, because we were BFFs like immediately.
Yeah. And I think for all of our regular listeners, they know that Chris and Sam and I all became instant BFFs at work. So it's kind of fun that we seem to attract the same kind of people outside of David's tea for once. We're talking today about queer horror, which is a fave topic of mine and of Chris's and of Sam's and of Max's. Max, what does horror mean to you?
What does horror mean to me? I think as a genre of film, I think horror is something that explores like the spaces that people find, you know, uncomfortable or make them nervous or make them scared, obviously, but it's more than that. Like I don't believe horror is just like violence or action or jump scares. Best horror kind of exists in that space of like, ooh, I have like this creepy crawly feeling on my neck. So it's something that sort of explores kind of what's in the shadows. Sometimes that's literal, but sometimes that's just like metaphoric, that what's in the background, what makes us uncomfortable. And it explores that in a very mass entertainment way. And I think that's one thing that makes the genre stick out and makes the old movies worth watching. I think a lot about like how, you know, genre movies are basically the only movies I watch anymore, horror, comedies, things like that. And I think one of the reasons is because it just gets that root to that really guttural sort of like, I'm uncomfortable, I'm a bit freaked out, but I kind of like that.
I like that. I love your definition because I don't know if I've seen a whole lot of horror movies, but I've seen scary movies and I've seen thrillers. And I think the definition of horror, it encompasses everything that I've seen and yet nothing that I've seen, because I don't know if there's a whole lot that I've seen that does it perfectly. Do you have a favorite horror film right now?
My all-time favorite horror movie is The Wicker Man. I love The Wicker Man so much. I watch it like at least once a year, usually on May Day. And it was my like entry point to folk horror, which I'm really interested in. And so now I kind of apply that lens to a lot of the other movies I watch, because I think some of my other favorites, like Candyman, the original Candyman, is folk horror as well, and that's one I really love. But just because this is a queer podcast, I have to put in a shout out to Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, which is also a horror movie, but in a very different sense of it. And I know we're going to talk about kind of why this appeals to people of our community and things like that, but like I like that movie. Like, I also went through a period of just watching all the time, and the more you know it, the more you see quotes from it, people in the know just like shouting lines, and that's like a big thing always historically for our community, is like people appropriating things from these like classic movies and taking them out of context and having fun with them. And whatever, Baby Jane, watching that for the first time when I was a bit older, like I was at least in university, I think, when I watched it, felt like I was like, oh, now I'm like part of a club.
Members only club.
Members only.
I wanted to, or I'm wondering, because you mentioned that the kind of shadowy parts of humanity are kind of in horror films, and you mentioned that it's like the metaphorical shadowy parts too. I'm wondering how like you feel about it tying to queerness, because like obviously queer people have been kind of in the shadows of humanity for a while at least, and kind of tend to still be.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of things going on with horror movies that either touch on directly or thematically on queerness. I think that there's a thing that happened, particularly if we're talking about movies like pre the 1990s, where, you know, straight mainstream directors were touching on these issues, just knowing, having a sense that people were uncomfortable with them and it would scare them. You know, I'm thinking of the way that Norman Bates is treated in Psycho, or, you know, Sleepaway Camp, you know, these movies that, you know, have a very problematic way of dealing with difference. But in kind of what I was speaking to a little bit before, of how, you know, queer people have a very highly tuned kind of nuanced relationship with pop culture, where we often take mainstream things that are not necessarily created for us, pick up on some of those like themes, symbolism, you know, the way characters are presented, and kind of reclaim them or turn it around. You know, queer characters will be portrayed as villains. You know, famously nowadays, we talk about all of the Disney villains that, you know, come across as queer, but then, you know, we watch it and we want to be Ursula, or we want to be Scar, like, obviously. And so I think we have a way of taking it and reversing the message. And I think that's one thing that horror has that really stands out. Horror is almost always subversive. Like, even if there is a happy ending and order is restored, you still can't shake the way things have been upended in the plot. And people who are not supposed to die, and heroes is reversed, things like that. So it's inherently subversive in that way. But then there's also another thing happening with horror where, you know, you go back far enough and you have actual queer creators and directors like James Whale, who directed, you know, Frankenstein, you know, putting in the experience of the other into the actual like subtext of the film, and that there's something that we kind of identify with, again, identifying with the monster, you know, the creature, the one who's been shunted out, and we see some humanity in that, and it allows us to like kind of feel powerful in watching that. So getting back to your question of like, you know, we see like the metaphor, the darkness there, and I think that, you know, saying that a lot of directors put that in there without, you know, maybe thinking it all through in their earlier times, and now we can kind of reclaim them and look back on it. But then, you know, since, I don't know, 80s, 90s, you know, you then have it more deliberately woven through. And I'm not an expert on more like contemporary movies that that have it less of a subtext and more of like a direct representation. But I think there's much more kind of playing to the fan base now, playing that, you know, we have like queer characters, queer heroes, queer villains, that's more like on the surface now. So like, I think that just adds to kind of the whole legacy of this with the genre.
So Frankenstein was before the Hays Code. It's Hays Code, right? The Frankenstein was before that.
Yeah, just how, before.
Do you know anything about the Hays Code? Would we be able to talk about it? Like, how did the Hays Code affect horror?
The Hays Code had a huge effect on horror, because right before the Hays Code came into effect in like 32, 33, I think, you see this like basically invention of the horror movie. You see in quick succession, you know, Phantom of the Opera, Frankenstein, Dracula, The Mummy, like these movies like in quick succession in the 20s and early 30s. And one of the appeals of them was violence. They don't look violent to our eyes, but like people at the time were like, oh my. Also kind of the sexuality of them, particularly with something like Dracula, where he was, you know, the monster, but also charming and seductive. And, you know, I'm not an expert on the making of those films, but I did read something that one of the few places that like Dracula had censor issues was that they said like Dracula cannot bite men. You know, because that had been a thing in the book, and we're like, we can't show him biting men. Like that was too far. And of course it was, because they're, you know, it's very sexual. Like that's clearly what's going on there. And then the Hays Code came in, and they could get away with showing far less violence, far less of like the subversiveness of those movies. And it became much more, you know, coded, and the villains had to be much less sympathetic and much more, you know, they had to kind of be sure to die at the end. And you have the contrast of, say, Dracula, something like Dracula's Daughter, which is from the later 30s, which is in some ways more queer than Dracula. In Dracula's Daughter, it's Dracula's daughter, and she's trying not to be a vampire, even though she knows it's kind of in her nature to be. And she even like tries to get a psychiatrist to help her with it and all this kind of stuff that, you know, it seems very, very much like a metaphor for queerness. But by the end, abandons that, embraces her vampirism, and then, you know, obviously has to die at the end. So it made it turn much more kind of metaphoric, much more secretive and symbolic. And this was just in general with queerness in movies in the 30s. It went from something that in the 20s and 30s you could touch on to something that had to be hinted at. You had to read between the lines, and ultimately associated with villainry, and that they had to kind of be killed by the end.
So interesting. I honestly don't think I had heard of the Hays Code until I started doing research for this episode, because I know everyone, well, most people these days understand that there's censorship regulations within film and within TV, but it's so interesting that that specific thing where Dracula couldn't bite men, but could bite women because of the sexuality of it all and the sensuality of that specific line. And I think the people who got up in arms, rightly so, about Disney putting queer characters in their shows and their books and their movies, I think most of them are completely unaware that this has been going on, this queer coding of characters has been going on since pre-30s, but specifically, especially since the Hays Code came around. Because everyone, especially Disney, can look at a Disney movie and go, oh yeah, we were choosing our Disney icon for our Disney account the other day, and immediately my partner was like, Scar or Ursula? And I was like, of course those are two of our, you know, top picks.
I think there's a couple of things going on there. There's the fact that like queer people are real and like are going to exist whether you write them in like specifically as characters, you make it very clear. Because sometimes when they make it, you know, when there's like a movie, and especially I feel like some of the new Disney movies where they're like, there's finally a queer character, and they're like at the supermarket and they have like a rainbow shirt on, and we're like, you know, like,
or LeFou.
Like, yeah.
LeFou in A New Beauty and the Beast. We were yeah. robbed of that.
But so it's like, we're going to exist. We existed. People, you know, tend to think that before Stonewall or before, you know, that it just never was touched on. And that's like not true. It's going to come through. And then I think specifically with film is you had a situation where you had a lot of queer people in the industry who are going to put in things that can be read a couple different ways. Again, kind of can appeal to symbols and metaphors a bit more. And you have an audience that was craving representation and a way to connect with each other. You know, the whole Friend of Dorothy phenomenon where, you know, queer people would use references to something as conservative as old movie musicals as a way of like finding each other. So we like what I find so interesting is like I look at the way queer people embraced old Hollywood heroines like Bette Davis or Joan Crawford, and then I see something quite similar in the way we approach something like Real Housewives, you know, where it's the same sort of like this baby isn't actually about us, but we will take it and reformat it into something that is inherently kind of like has a queer fan base and is it speaks to us, and you know, and I think that that's a it's a different in some ways like much more nuanced story than just pure representation of like unique queer characters. It's like we also have a queer take on mainstream culture that you can't suppress.
Yeah, I think it's always so fun to watch new movies with friends and see which characters they align themselves with after a movie. I think it shows so much about the person and also about the different experiences that you have. And I, you know, I'm gonna ask about what you said about the queer community co-opting those specific characters in movies. And I know we look at mainstream horror and we look at those, you know, I think of how many Scream videos or movies there's been and how many remakes there's been. And there's always, I mean, Jamie Lee Curtis is a queer icon for the ages, period. But I don't think that, at least, I mean, these days she might be quite aware of it, but she didn't set out to become that in that franchise. And yet the queer community took one look at her and her portrayal of that character and said, yeah, that's how I can see myself, specifically as like this final girl hero character.
Yeah, I mean, I having just watched, my partner and I watch all the Halloween movies every October. So I'm like in the midst of Hayden Field right now. Having just watched it, you know, you think Laurie Strode, she's like the Girl Scout, as her friends make fun of her. She's like the good babysitter out of, you know, her friends. She's the one who never has a date. Like what's queer about that? But there is, when you watch that movie, there is something inherently queer and identifiable about the final girls who are cliche to be the good ones, but maybe like the slightly nerdy one, you know, the cheerleaders, the more popular girls can be easily killed off. You know, the varsity jocks, the, you know, the popular kids can get knocked off easily. And then it's like a mousy figure, like the good babysitter who turns out she has like the strength internally that she can turn the tables on the killer. And there's something very sort of wish fulfillment and empowering about that figure.
I think that's really interesting because like, looking at, for example, The Bride of Frankenstein, and when the Bride of Frankenstein is created, she wakes up and she's essentially created for Frankenstein, right? And then she wakes up and is like, no, you can't tell me who I'm going to be with. And that's inherently queer too. And so like the idea of the person who lasts to the end and is kind of like they almost set their own destiny. Like it's it's very queer in that way. And I just see a parallel there, and that's, I just think it's interesting.
Absolutely. And like two things on that. I think which Nightmare on Elm Street is it? Nightmare on Elm Street 2 with the final boy. You know, the it's the one that instead of having a final girl, it has a final boy. Like he's the main character, and you know, it's as though the director was consciously picking up on this queer vibe of that character, and then he cast a gay actor who wasn't out at the time, and they've made a whole documentary about this phenomenon of how he faced like this basically homophobic backlash due to the feelings around that movie and his performance in it, and kind of threw his career off the rails and all of this kind of stuff. But I think it's one of those times where like creative people, like directors, script writers, they respond to stuff and they don't always really know what they're responding to. Again, it's like, you know, what we were speaking of before, you know, that movie was from the 80s. They're picking up on homophobia. They're picking up on, you know, panic around AIDS, and they're working that into, you know, a horror movie about, you know, a guy who kills you in your sleep with, you know, a bunch of, you know, shearing claws or whatever. But I had never watched Bride and Frankenstein until the past year. So I'm glad I did before this came up. But yeah, I mean, I was shocked at how little screen time she has. She's so, like, first of all, can we talk about how famous, like how a fabulous hairstyle can make you like iconic? Like she has like 10 minutes of screen time, and yet we all know her look. And it, you're absolutely right. She wakes up. She does not want anything to do with this big, lumbering, monstrous, you know, guy. And they don't really, like, I think he kind of wants her, but, like, it's just this mismatch. And there is something very queer about that of, like, no, like, you made me, but I'm not going to be who you want me to be. I'm going to, you know, I'd rather, like, tear down this castle and destroy everything than, you know, go along with what you expect. And again, that's a James Whale movie, and you could totally see his influence there.
I think it's so interesting that we can sit here and talk about movies throughout the decades and talk about how we know that our community as queer people, there's artists, there's cinematographers, there's writers, there's makeup artists. We're everywhere within the film industry. And yet sometimes it feels like we're the only ones who say, well, obviously there's a queer-coded character, or there's queer-coded writing, or there's a queer-coded movement that happens in these films throughout the years. And now I know that it's louder now. The homophobia and the queerphobia is louder now, and that's why people are talking about it. But, you know, I think it's really interesting because we get spin-offs of all of these other movies. We get Lion King 2, Scar didn't get a movie. We get Little Mermaid 2 and 3, which were trash, but Ursula didn't get a movie. And I just think there's so much homophobia in, and I'm partially joking, I think there's so much homophobia in that, but also it seems as if sometimes we're the only ones who see the queerness in these films. And yet as soon as we start talking about it, as soon as we start celebrating it, it's immediately shut down as if like the straights really can't see it. And that's, for me, that's the thing that just, it gets me every time. I'm like, you really didn't see this? You didn't see any of this coming?
And I think that that's one of the powerful things of it, because when you make movies that are just like direct representation, occasionally it works, but for every Brokeback Mountain, like there's like 20, you know, Bros or something, Fire Islands, you know, things that are very, very, very directly non-metaphorically queer, and they don't light up the world, you know. And I think by weaving our stories into more mainstream targeted products, as well as then interpreting them in the way we do, it's our way of like being part of that mainstream, but also at the same time being like, but we're in it on our own terms. And we could take values that you think are in there and like subvert them or see some difference in them, you know, identify with the bad guy when you tell us not to identify with the bad guy and things like that. And I think it's our way of playing with the same toy box as everybody else, but just doing it in a different way.
Yeah.
I think there should be an origin story for Ursula, the same way they made, you know, those Angelina Jolie movies about Maleficent. I feel like we all want to find out like how Ursula got that way. What's her backstory?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And it would totally happen if Angelina Jolie said yes to playing Ursula. I don't love her as an actress, but I know what power she has in Hollywood. And I mean, that could be pretty.
You're just putting that out there in the universe now.
I am. I'm just like, it's not like a full-on manifestation. It's like a low-key manifestation.
Honestly, if they do an Ursula backstory, I really hope that they actually make it a drag queen this time, because Ursula is literally made after Divine. Like, it's not even like really that coded. It's like it's out there, and a lot of like even some straight people do know that, like, the once we got to like the 90s, people knew that gay people existed. Like, it wasn't like it was completely under the ground and like, you know. But what's interesting is I see a kind of a thing where like queerness has always existed, and we've talked about it a couple of times in this podcast. Queerness has always existed, and in fact the horror genre was kind of like slightly invented by queer people. Like Mary Shelley is queer, Bram Stoker is queer, like those kinds of things are ours. And yet you're right, there is some like subversive part to it that straight people just don't see, but I think it's just because it's not within their experience, and so because of that they see these coded evil characters as bad, and there's no, for them it's black and white. Like, they are a very black and white type of people, and so because of that,
boring. You can say boring.
I can say boring. Okay, good.
Do any of them listen to this podcast?
Maybe. If you're listening to this podcast, you're straight. We mean no offense.
No, I think you're right. I think you hit the nail on the head of like they don't see it because it's not their experience. It's not the way that they're used to consuming these stories. They're not used to, you know, trying to read between the lines of things in that way and see these kind of, you know, undercurrents in them. But it allows us the freedom to kind of put those into the stories a bit undercover, with like a little bit more protection. But when it becomes too far, you know, with that notorious Nightmare on Elm Street film or some other examples where it becomes too queer, then you're like, oh no, we hate it, you know, like it's too far. You know, the thing that happened with Disco, you know, Disco for a moment was mainstream popular, and then you have this very homophobic and racist like backlash against it, you know, pretty soon when it's like, oh, there's too many queer people who are like coming to the forefront with this. So, you know, it always kind of has to like play that delicate dance there.
So interesting. I don't know if anybody knows about the Owl House. It's like a recent cartoon on Disney. It's kind of along the same lines of like horror. It's not really horror. It's not. It's a cartoon. It's for children. But and it's lovely. But there's some scary parts like that children probably would find scary. But it's fun because like a lot of the characters are queer and they're just kind of written in as they're just, that's who they are, and it's fine. And then Disney kind of canceled it because it was a little bit too queer, but they also allowed a third season, and the third season is queerer than ever. It's so blatant. They have like the mom is reading like break the binary books, and like there's bisexual flags everywhere, and like there's a lesbian flag in one of it, and like there's queer couples all over the place. There's people like gender non-conforming in everything. And so like essentially like what's really cool about it is that like in like historically, if something had blocked them, we would find a different way to do it. But now it seems that things can be overtly queer and successful. Like even the new slasher flick, they slash them, is overtly queer, and it's about and it's supposed to, like, I don't know if it's supposed to scare us. I think it's supposed to scare us a little bit. Like, I think it's geared toward us because like it's about conversion camp and how scary it can be. And so I just find it really interesting that we've come to this place where like there are queer characters that are out queer characters, which is really cool. And some of them are good characters as well, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope that, you know, just like, you know, Get Out had a mainstream mass audience, I hope that people turn to something like They Them. And even if it's about something like conversion therapy camps, where like where a lot of the straight people would have no like experience with anything similar to that, I would hope that they could still watch it and see the horror of like the in reality horror of it, like not just like this is like some made-up thing, because like in a way it's like that could be the best outcome of a plot like that, because we know as queer people to be scared of things like that, but to be able to like get that same isn't this awful idea, you know, out there to people who maybe knew nothing about this experience and never cared to research or, you know, learn about it. I think that would be a great outcome of a film like that.
That's actually really profound. I didn't even think of the connection between like something like Get Out, where it's like overtly about race and it taught, you know, certain like white people that there are reasons to be scared, you know, like Maybe it'll teach straight and cis people that there are reasons to be scared, you know?
Yeah, I think that those two were connected on my mind, because I remember my partner and our friend and I like sitting around after watching Get Out at some point and saying like how, like basically talking through the idea of They Them before they had made that movie, of like, if you were making, if could you make a similar style movie about the horrors of something like conversion therapy, you know, it's not therapy, conversion camps, like what that would look like, would that be a way of showing people, making it more real to people? You know, and again, I think that this is why I'm a fan of horror. It can approach these really quite serious topics in a way that is a little bit more like creative and digestible for people. Like it's a way of getting to think about these like profound things like death, like homophobia, like racism. Like I think horror is like tons of it are about like sexism and misogyny and things like that, and it's a way of getting approaching those topics in a genre that is kind of known for being, you know, a light genre, or like a genre that's like not, you know, these movies aren't going to win best Oscar, you know, best movie at the Oscars, you know. I think that that's something really, really interesting about horror.
One of the first like horror movies I remember watching was called Idle Hands.
Mm-hmm.
And Max, it doesn't surprise me that you are nodding, because I feel like everyone who I've told is like, I don't know what that is.
I am nodding because I remember the trailers for it, but I don't think I actually ever saw it.
So I'm going to set the scene a little. So get cozy. So I'm 10 or 11 years old. I'm in Newfoundland with my family, and a girl down the street invites little Kellum to go watch a scary movie. I wasn't related to her, which is usually what people ask, because that's the joke in Newfoundland. I checked and I was like, okay, we're gonna go watch this movie and I'm gonna hold her hand when I get scared. I didn't get that scared, so I didn't get to hold her hand. Also, she was playing with a Rubik's Cube the entire time, so that would have been awkward because I'm not very good at Rubik. So I could have been like, here, let me try, let me hold your hand. Basically, the premise is that the main character gets possessed, and it plays on the premise, the verse from the Bible that says, if your hand causes you to sin, chop it off. And so his hand gets possessed and he murders his parents, and then he goes and murders around a bunch of other people. It's jump scare. It's like dark humor, funny, horror, ? I don't know. But it's one of those movies where like, it's literally just at the end of the movie, it's literally just this severed hand dragging a knife, walking down the street, and like fade to black. And it's this idea of like the things that go bump in the night that like, we're told to watch out for, like this Bible verse, which I remember hearing growing up, was like, if your hand causes you to sin, chop it off. If your eye causes you, you know, all of those things that shouldn't be terrifying or shouldn't be told to children because they're terrifying, all these like coded messages that we get in films. And it's just like, oh, well, it's fine. It's just a simple message. And it gets used in horror all the time. And every time I watch a new scary movie, I think of my experience watching that movie. Because while I can't tell you anything about the characters, I can tell you that that one message of if your hand causes you to sin, chop it off, and you know it'll become this like possessed, decapitated hand. And then every time I watch a new movie, I think about the simple message that comes out of it.
I feel like this whole time I haven't had anything to say. Hi, I've been here for a minute. But I just haven't really had much to tack onto because I kind of like literally agree with everything. But specifically, Callum, with what you're saying right now, there, I think that's my favorite part about the horror genre is that if you, even like the jump scare ones that, you know, are just like for fun, there's no real premise to it. There are so many hidden things in there. And the metaphor behind when we were to really drag it back to the beginning here with like Frankenstein and stuff like that, like a lot of the horror and all of these things have so many small messages threaded in it that if you are somebody who really enjoys that genre, you're going to notice those things and you're going to appreciate them. And I think that's why I think it's been said in this already as well, just that, you know, horror is kind of about the underdog succeeding. And I think as queer people, we can relate to that because it feels that way, you know? And I just, that's my little tidbit. So people know that I swear, I just feel like this conversation has just flown so well. And I just like didn't have much to touch on, but specifically with what you're touching on right now, Callum, I was like, yeah, that really stands out to me. I agree.
Yeah. So. I mean, for the, like, maybe we could just go around, but like, is there a film experience the way Callum was describing of one that like maybe was at like a formative age that of a scary movie that like meant a lot to you that now looking back, or maybe even at the time, was partly because of its like queer resonance to you? Does anybody have an experience like that from when they were watching the movie years ago?
My only experience, like I used to be scared shitless of horror. So I did not watch it. The first movie that I watched that was scary was Resident Evil. And I was afraid of zombies for years. And so like, I just couldn't handle it. The scariest that I would like identify with would have been Disney villains, which I mean, it's fine, I guess, but like, I don't know, like Cruella DeVille being Cruella DeVille was like, you know, formative for me. I don't know. And even like The Black Cauldron, which is a Disney movie, it's scary. And I was scared. I never watched that again. You know, like I was so scared.
I know somebody our age who had nightmares and has not watched it since then, like still has nightmares. Yeah.
Disney buried that film for that reason. It was just so out of pocket for them that like they really like that era of film for Disney, they have buried deep down because of that. And it's just so interesting. Like there is like a cult following for Black Cauldron for sure, because it is just so not within what we think of Disney nowadays. I would say I grew up watching horror because of my mom and sister. Like it was something we watched so continuously. I don't think there's maybe per se like one specific film that stands out. I think I really just fell in love with horror because of the whole understanding that it is usually an underdog that survives. Or I just felt, you know, just more in tune with maybe who I am and the way that I wanted to present. I was like, oh yeah, I want to be like edgy. I like horror. So like, but I will say House of a Thousand Corpses, Cheryl Moon, Rob Zombie's wife, that was my love for her I didn't quite understand until later on, but that would probably be maybe my thing for that. So
I just did a quick Google because I had no idea what that was, and I understand it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So realistically, I like the sequel to that movie so much more because the end is Lynyrd Skynyrd Freebird playing, and it's probably one of my favorite scenes in any movie ever. And it correlates back to Burning Sam for sure. That's why I want Lynyrd Skynyrd playing One of My Body's Ablaze When I Die. But because of that scene in that movie, but she is just, and her relationship with Rob is just like really cool. But House of the Thousand Corpses is definitely more, it's questionable if I watch it now because I'm like, oof, but the gore and like, and just like the things that they do in it is really just kind of unsettling and super bizarre. But I kind of like that because it was just like, we're out here to just do a bunch of weird stuff and have this really creepy storyline and have it be gory and kind of gross and icky. And it's like, I don't know. I like that part of horror. Not as much anymore, but I don't know. Those films just always stood out to me. So, and she's just a whole ass snack if we're being honest. So it is what it is.
I think there's definitely something to be said. Like, it just occurred to me that like the people who were weirdos in high school, if not earlier, and grew up and managed to hold on to their weirdness and find each other, those are the people who are making horror movies. And that has been the case probably since the beginning of Hollywood.
1,000%.
And so we like gravitate towards like, this is like some weird shit that they're doing here. But like, I would have totally sat in the music hallway with them in high school. You know, like, I get them.
Yeah, I feel like any of the friends that I had that like have shared my love for horror, like really like, and it extends beyond the confines of just film. Like if we're going to talk about horror as a genre, it's now in games. Like Silent Hill, of course, has been around for quite some time. Like the movie is based off of the game, but you know, there's like a huge cult following with that. And the games for that are just, you know, has enthralled people for so long. And then it kind of went to, you know, PS4 launched like their motion control thing. And with that came Until Dawn, which is a horror game. And then now you have Phasmophobia, which is like a multiplayer horror game. And it just like extends to all these like so many different things. And it's, I don't know. I'm a big horror person. I like it. I like being scared. And like Until Dawn storyline's just pretty phenomenal as well. This is a pretty stellar name, but yeah, I feel like it is the weirdos who are kind of making those things and you just kind of relate to it. Yeah.
I think that's a really good call that it's not just film, because like, for me, I know that when I started embracing like my love for folk horror, I started discovering that like, oh, there's not just one indie zine about folk horror. There's like a whole bunch of them, and they've all started in the last 5-10 years or so. There's a very active Facebook groups, people are sharing stuff all the time. There's YouTube channels called Spooky Old Horror, British Horror Shows, and things like that, where they just put all this stuff from the BBC from the 70s that otherwise would be really hard for us to watch. Like I have a AI account dedicated to like AI art inspired by folk horror. Like there's this whole like scene. And that goes way beyond just film. And I think that that's something that like horror, like the fan base of horror, it's like multi-platform. Like the people who love Halloween don't just like love the films of Halloween. They love knowing everything about the whole cast and all the different like timelines of the different sequels, and like go to the fan expos, like, you know, get the merch and meet the, you know, who played, you know, Laurie's daughter and all of this kind of stuff. So it's like a whole scene that, and I think it has that different than a lot of genres, that maybe Marvel movies are a bit like that, but like that's the only comparable one where I could think of, like, it really is a community as well.
Oh, I was just gonna say, like, the cult following behind like horror as a whole is insane. Like, again, like Silent Hill, if we're gonna talk about Pyramid Head, I can't tell you how many variations of Pyramid Head I've seen. I've seen sexy Pyramid Head really taken off, like sexy Scream Mask going on right now. Like the cosplays for that. And like, and I Marvel, I guess you could say, yeah, it is a bit comparable in terms of like the mass amount of people that love it. But I feel like the difference with horror is that it is really more of a cult following. And it is like these people wanting to know the ins and outs of everything. And it's not just this love of the movies and like, oh, they're action and they're superheroes and blah. Like when it comes to like these horror films, it's, I don't know how to explain it, but like the vibe of it and the people that connect over it are so different. and why they love it and why they're intrigued by it is because like they are these underdogs and they're seeing themselves in these roles, and maybe, okay, maybe it's not always the best, but you know, there's something so much deeper in horror that scratches this itch in people. And I think that's why, I don't know, I think that's why it's so interesting, because there's so many things, like if we're going to talk about psychological horror, which is more so my favorite, like Shutter Island, maybe isn't necessarily seen as like a scary movie, but at the same time, like the horror at the end of that film, the realization with that plot twist in there, like that should, like in my opinion, I do consider that scary, because it's just like, who would have thought, you know? And if you haven't seen it, you should. I don't know why anyone hasn't seen it. It's amazing. But like, I feel like that should be encapsulated within that as well, because I don't know, like that, it, I don't know. It just scratches an itch that other movies don't, because it has you thinking. Like you brought up Get Out, and that one was just amazing. We can bring up Midsommar. We can bring up, what was the one prior to that? Hereditary. Like it's a slow burn. And then all of a sudden it picks up and you're like, holy shit.
These are all pretty queer movies. Like thinking about all of these movies that you're listing, they're pretty queer. And I would say that like even the cults that follow them, like I'm thinking of the biggest cult that I would be part of would be Rocky Horror Picture Show. And I was thinking about how Dr. Frankenfurter was like, I was like, who else would it be? Like what horror movie? And it was like, oh, I like the weird ones. So like Dr. Frankenfurter was like someone who kind of woke something up in me. And that's like the queer followings, or sorry, the cults tend to be a little bit queer too. Like they're the weirdos. They're the ones that are like, you know, it just, absolutely, it seems like that, right?
And like Rocky Horror Picture Show is basically saying like, look at how queer these old Universal monster movies are. We're going to turn it into like a rock musical in which like the only plot is really that we're corrupting this like innocent couple, you know, like, and doing all sorts of, like, it's just so taking the, you know, the subtextual thing there, just like putting it forefront and being like, yeah, no, this is what's actually happening on, and you have to dress up in order to pretend that's how weird it is.
I love Rocky Horror. It's a part of my personality. And I feel like the difference between the cult following of Marvel and the cult following of like horror genre, in my opinion, and Sam, I think you kind of got it, where like it like scratches an itch in different kinds of people. My youngest brother, huge Marvel fan, but is also like a Lord of the Rings fan and a Tolkien fan and a Star Wars fan. And so like we overlap in that way, but at the same time, the all-encompassing nature of people who are like horror fans, it gets you in a way where you don't have to talk about it. And I think that's like the biggest thing for me, because you get a bunch of Marvel fans together, which I've witnessed my brother do, and all they want to talk about is their fan theories. That's all they want to do. They want to talk about their fan theories. They want to talk about how it differs from the comics. They want to, you get a bunch of horror fans together and they just want to sit in silence and watch the movie. Unless you're like Max and I, where you want to discuss all of the queer coded things within the movie. But that,
or you're discussing like the maybe not the fan theories, like you said, but like, or not the, like sit in silence, but like be like, oh, and this is why they did this. And did you know that they actually used real cow's blood in this scene? And you're like, what the hell?
Yeah, I mean, we watch all of the Halloween movies every year, not because they're all good, but like it's a very uneven series, but uneven in an interesting way. Like to watch the variation between them, in a way it's like, you're like doing a film course of like, look at like, the mistakes this one made, they were misunderstanding what this, you know, series should be about. And look at, and then you're also like looking at, look at Paul Rudd, baby Paul Rudd showing up, and you know, his first movie part, like Sam was saying, it's like this, you know, like you're like pulling in all the IMDb trivia as well, and it's like, girl, like your appreciation for it in that way. I think there's something, I've been wanting to say this, Sam was talking about The Crush, but like I think there's something really like also like connected between like horror and sexuality that's really interesting, like that, like I don't know about any of you, but probably like I follow multiple Instagram accounts that have like sexy scream face, sexy Jason Voorhees, sexy, like, it's just like, and I'm like, there's something very sexual about this genre. I want, you know, and I don't think it is as simple as like, oh, and some, they cast hint, like hot actors who we see like in various like phases of undress, you know, getting kind of killed at some point. Like, that's part of it, but there's got to be something a bit deeper that we're actually like sexualizing like the killers or the monsters. Like, there's got to be something deeper than that as well.
The monster fetish. I found myself on that TikTok for a hot minute. I was like, how did I get here and how do I leave? But like, not to kink shame, but yeah, like there is like this like it correlates to like people being into masks, and like that's why they're doing that with Pyramid Head and Scream and stuff. And it's so interesting because you're like, what the fuck? But also you're kind of like, this is kind of cool, I'm kind of into this. Like Jessica Nagiri, I think is her last name, she's a very famous cosplayer, and she did a Pyramid Head, and it's like a pink Pyramid Head, and it's a sexy Pyramid Head, and I'm like, I stand behind this for sure, 1,000%.
I just did a quick Google and yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay,
I love it.
We're the same person. I did the same Google.
I think it's so interesting, the line between like scary and sexy. And it's so interesting because when you get into the BDSM world, there's the same line of like, am I scared or am I turned on? Am I scared or am I turned off? And it's such a fine line, I find, when you're reading about it, when you're participating in it, and then you get to a point where you're like, you can kind of relinquish control of your fears. And I think that's the biggest thing with horror genre, because fear is such a strong emotion and you don't always know what your reaction to it is going to be. And so I hold on to fear so closely because I don't know what my reaction is going to be and what is it going to, how is it going to affect what, not my fear, but my reaction to my fear. How are other people going to see me reacting to this scene or this movement or this action? And I think just like things that are sexual, we've been taught and asked by society to control all of our reactions to things that are sensual or things that are outright sexy. And we're told these are the boundaries in which you can react to this. You can tell someone they're beautiful, or you can tell someone that they look great, but watch what you say after that.
Speaking of like the connection of like sexuality and horror, like there's this Quebecois movie, Tom at the Farm, with Xavier Dolan. And like, not many people have seen this, I don't think, but it's like, he plays a gay guy who goes back, like his partner dies, and he goes to the like small farm that the partner is from. And like the partner has this like hunky older brother who like runs the farm now. And he like the main character kind of gets trapped there. And there's these scenes where the brother is like getting in his physical space. And it completely lives on this line between like, is it scary? Is there a threat of violence, or are they going to start screwing around? Like, it's like, and you cannot tell. And it's so uncomfortable. The whole movie has that tension. And it never, like, it just doesn't break, but it puts you in this uncomfortable situation that, you know, we were getting at of like, am I turned on or am I scared or am I like a little bit of both? And is this like politically problematic? Like, what's going on here? Like, how could he be like aroused but also fearful? And like, what's, you know, like, but there's something very connected about those feelings. And I think that that's what a lot of filmmakers pick up on and like exploit for the movies, because like that sort of tension is similar.
Max, I'm wondering if you want to touch on camp sensibility in horror.
Oh, yeah. Interestingly, I had this colleague at one point. I used to work at a cafe, and he didn't know the term camp had anything to do not with horror. He only knew the term camp in terms of campy old horror movies. And like, to the point where he didn't, this was like not a person of our community, like didn't even really associate with like queer stuff. And I'm like, that's so interesting that I'm so far removed from the community that you only think it refers to like Godzilla or like, you know, old, you know, horror movies. So yeah, I mean, I think that there is something about like the queer fan base of horror movies that is reliant a bit on having like a camp attitude to them, and that you like can't take them fully seriously. Like you get scared, you're edge of your seat, but you know, you also like can't really treat like the deaths like real deaths. You can't get sad over them while watching for the most part. You know, you have to like, you know, see the blood as like, you know, it's over the topness of bright red splatters and all this kind of stuff. And it, you know, it goes back to like the roots of camp kind of with like Oscar Wilde of like this, you know, treating serious things frivolously. I think that is kind of also like part of the horror, you know, fandom that like, you know, when these cheerleaders, you know, get offed so easily, there's something over the top and almost kind of funny about it. Like it's not the real world, and it's a bit much. And if you don't have that sensibility, if you can't treat it kind of tongue in cheek like that, if you take it too literally, you're not going to enjoy it. You're going to be like, oh, this is awful. I don't get it.
Yeah, you almost have to reverse psychology yourself in order to, that's not a correct phrase. I really hope my English teachers aren't listening for a multitude of reasons. You almost have to flip it in your brain to say, okay, this is being shown, this scary thing is being shown to me, but actually it's funny. And I have a feeling that for queer people, that's something that we do quite often, where we're like, this situation that I'm in is scary, so I have to laugh about it or else I'll cry.
Yeah.
I have to make a joke because that'll subvert the attention away from the fact that I'm shitting my pants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that that's definitely in there. And I think is not explored enough in terms of the way people watch horror movies. And my favorite horror movies are a bit winking at you. Like they are kind of aware that what they're asking you to watch is a little bit ridiculous, but we're all in this, you know. Like I think you have to break the tension, you know, you have to break the tension by having something comedic, something a bit sexy, you know, and then also scary things, and that's like a good mixture.
I also think the part about retribution and vindication for so many of us watching the cheerleaders and the jocks die. My school was too small for any of us to actually be in cliques, but like you knew who the popular kids were. And so I remember I only watched Jennifer's Body the first time like this summer, and that's not horror, but it's one of those movies where like you silently cheer because you're like, huh, a little bit of vindication.
Yeah, and then when it's the reverse, like in like the sequel to It, like the new version, there's like an early scene where there's like a gay couple and Pennywise gets them. And it's kind of like, ew, like I don't need to see Pennywise get like a believable gay couple. Like,
yeah.
Like they, and what makes that scene more upsetting is they're actually like gay bashed, like on route to getting Pennywise, and instead of Pennywise going after the gay bashers, which would again be sort of like you'd be on kind of the monster's side there, that doesn't happen. Instead he goes after the gay couple, and it just felt weird watching it, being like, haven't they been through enough already with this? Like that's not nice.
I have learned so much about queer horror from you, Max. And I hope that everyone has learned a little bit from this episode, because we'll just say it. If you want to find queerness, you're going to find it in everything, but it's always easier to find it in things that it's coded into automatically. And horror, as soon as I knew what scary movies were, I also knew, and of course, as soon as I knew what queerness was, I can look back and say, yeah, there was queerness coded into that.
And yeah, and I think the only thing I'd add to that, sorry, not to interrupt, but the only thing I'd add to that is like, it, I hope what we got across is it's not always intentionally coded in there. So even if like director says, I didn't intend it that way, like that's the nature of art is that, you know, it's not up for even one person necessarily to say what a product is or isn't about. If you see it in there, if it speaks to you in that way, then that is a real interpretation of it. And I think, you know, with horror, it's like a lot, like it has both things going for it, deliberately woven into it, but also by some of the things we spoke about, by visualizing like things that we're scared of and comfortable with, maybe you're browsed by and things like that. We as queer people can see a lot in it, and like nobody can tell us that interpretation is incorrect. But like, can I just say, one reason Kellum and I became such good friends is that they totally indulged me in talking about the things that I love to talk about, like topics like this. And like, it to me, it as you become older, like it becomes harder to make those friends that you had in high school or like in university where you would just sit on someone's bed and just talk for all hours about everything. Like looking back, I'm like, what did we even spend all that time talking about? But you did. But the fact that I could make friends with somebody like Kellum at this stage of my life and still kind of find that is like a really, you know, wonderful thing for me. So like it was super comfortable to like when Kellum invited me on, I was like, yes, totally makes sense that we would get together and talk about this. So thank you so much.
We certainly loved having you. Thank you for coming.
Well, folks, thank you so much for listening. Get out there, be queer, and watch some scary movies this Halloween.
And all year.
Yes, all year.